Three or four days passed. Make it 3 days. As soon as we had our bearings, we ran straight for Port Royal. Hunter drummed his fingers on the table. He frowned at his empty wine glass. There was a short silence. Almon cleared his throat. "Captain Hunter, you seem preoccupied by this story."
"Intrigued," Hunter said. "I am sure the governor is equally intrigued."
"I believe," Almon said, "that it is fair to say the interests of the crown have been aroused." Hacklett sat stiffly in his chair.
"Sir James," he said, "would you edify the rest of us as to the import of all this?"
"Just a moment," Almon said, with an impatient wave of the hand. He was looking fixedly at Hunter. "What terms do you make?"
"Equal division, first," Hunter said.
"My dear Hunter, equal division is most unattractive to the crown."
"My dear governor, anything less would make the expedition most unattractive to the seamen."
Almon smiled. "You recognize, of course, that the prize is enormous."
"Indeed. I also recognize that the island is impregnable. You sent Edmonds with 300 men against it last year. Only one returned."
"You yourself have expressed the opinion that Edmonds was not a resourceful man."
"But Kazala is certainly resourceful."
"Indeed. And yet it seems to me that Kazala is a man you should like to meet."
"Not unless there was an equal division."
"But," Sir James said, smiling in an easy way, "if you expect the crown to outfit the expedition, that cost must be returned before any division." "Fair?"
"Hear now," Hacklett said. "Sir James, are you bargaining with this man?"
"Not at all. I am coming to a gentleman's agreement with him."
"For what purpose?"
"For the purpose of arranging a privateering expedition on the Spanish outpost at Montenceros."
"Montenceros," Morton said.
"That is the name of the island you passed, Captain Morton. Punta Montenceros. The Don built a fortress there 2 years ago under the command of an unsavory gentleman named Kazala. Perhaps you've heard of him? No? Well, he has a considerable reputation in the Indies. He is said to find the screams of his dying victims restful and relaxing."
Almont looked at the faces of his dinner guests. Mrs. Hacklett was quite pale.
"Kazala commands the fortress of Montenceros, built for the sole purpose of being the farthest eastern outpost of Spanish dominion along the homeward route of the treasure fleet."
There was a long silence. The guests looked uneasy.
"I see you do not comprehend the economics of this region," Almont said. "Each year, Philip sends a fleet of treasure galleons here from Cadiz. They cross to the Spanish main, sighting first land to the south off the coast of New Spain. There, the fleet disperses, traveling to various ports, Cartagena, Veracruz, Portobello, to collect treasure. The fleet regroups in Havana, then travels east back to Spain. The purpose of traveling together is protection against privateering raids. Am I clear?"
They all nodded.
"Now," Almon continued, "the Armada sails in late summer, which is the onset of the hurricane season. From time to time it has happened that ships have been separated from the convoy early in the voyage. The Don wanted a strong harbor to protect such ships. They built Montenceros for this reason alone."
"Surely that is not sufficient reason," Hacklett said. "I cannot imagine—"
"It is ample reason," Almon said abruptly. "Now then, as luck would have it, 2 treasure naos were lost in a storm some weeks ago. We know because they were sighted by a privateer vessel, which attacked them unsuccessfully. They were last seen beating southward, making for Montenceros. One was badly damaged. What you, Captain Morton, called a Spanish warship was obviously one of these treasure galleons. If it had been a genuine warship, it would surely have given chase at a 2-mile range and captured you
and even now you would be screaming your lungs out for Kazala's amusement. The ship did not give chase because it dared not leave the protection of the harbor.
How long will it stay there? Morton asked.
It may leave at any time, or it may wait until the next fleet departs, next year. Or it may wait for a Spanish warship to arrive and escort it home.
Can it be captured? Morton asked.
One would like to think so. In aggregate, the treasure ship probably contains a fortune worth 500,000 pounds.
There was a stunned silence around the table.
I felt, Almont said with amusement, that this information would interest Captain Hunter.
You mean this man is a common privateer?
Demanded Hacklett.
Not common in the least, Almont said, chuckling.
Captain Hunter?
Not common, I would say.
But this levity is outrageous.
You forget your manners, Almont said. Captain Hunter is the second son of Major Edward Hunter of the Massachusetts Bay Colony. He was, in fact, born in the New World and educated at that institution. What is it called?
Harvard, Hunter said.
Yes, Harvard. Captain Hunter has been among us for 4 years, and as a privateer, he has some standing in our community. Is that a fair summation, Captain Hunter?
Only fair, Hunter said, grinning.
The man is a rogue,
Hacklett said, but his wife was looking at Hunter with new interest.
A common rogue!
You should mind your tongue, Almont said calmly. Dueling is illegal on this island, yet it happens with monotonous regularity. I regret there is little I can do to stop the practice.
I've heard of this man, Hacklett said, still more agitated. He is not the son of a Major Edward Hunter at all, at least not the legitimate son.
Hunter scratched his beard. Is that so?
I have heard it, Hacklett said. Further, I have heard he is a murderer, scoundrel, whoremonger, and pirate.
At the word pirate, Hunter's arm flicked out across the table with extraordinary speed. It fastened in Hacklett's hair and plunged his face into his half-eaten mutton. Hunter held him there for a long moment.
"Dear me," Almont said. "I warned him about that earlier. You see, Mr. Hacklett, privateering is an honorable occupation. Pirates, on the other hand, are outlaws. Do you seriously suggest that Captain Hunter is an outlaw?"
Hacklett made a muffled sound, his face in his food.
"I didn't hear you, Mr. Hacklett," Almont said.
"I said no,"
Hacklett said.
"Then don't you think it appropriate as a gentleman to apologize to Captain Hunter?"
"I apologize, Captain Hunter. I meant you no disrespect."
Hunter released the man's head. Hacklett sat back and wiped the gravy from his face with his napkin.
"There now," Almont said. "A moment of unpleasantness has been averted. Shall we take dessert?"
Hunter looked around the table. Hacklett was still wiping his face. Morton was staring at him with open astonishment. And Mrs. Hacklett was looking at Hunter, and when she caught his eye, she licked her lip. After dinner, Hunter and Almont sat alone in the library of the mansion drinking brandy. Hunter commiserated with the governor over the appointment of the new secretary.
"He makes my life no simpler," Almont agreed, "and I fear it may be the same for you."
"You think he'll send unfavorable dispatches to London?"
"I think he may try.
The king must surely know what transpires in his colony."
"That is a matter of opinion," Almont said with an airy gesture. "One thing is certain, the continued support of privateers will be assured if it repays the king handsomely."
"No less than an equal division," Hunter said quickly. "I tell you, it cannot be otherwise."
"But if the crown outfits your ships, arms your seamen—"
"No," Hunter said, "that will not be necessary."
"Not necessary? My dear Hunter, you know Matanceros. A full Spanish garrison is stationed there.
Hunter shook his head. A frontal assault will never succeed. We know that from the Edmonds expedition.
But what alternative is there? The fortress at Montanceros commands the entrance to the harbor. You cannot escape with the treasure ship without first capturing the fortress.
Indeed.
Well, then,
I propose a small raid from the landward side of the fortress.
Against a full garrison, at least 300 troops, you cannot succeed.
On the contrary, Hunter said. Unless we succeed, Cazalla will turn his guns on the treasure galleon and sink it at anchor in the harbor.
I hadn't thought of that, Almont said.
He sipped his brandy.
Tell me more of your plan.
Chapter 7. Later, as he was leaving the governor's mansion, Mrs. Hacklett appeared in the hall and came over to him.
Captain Hunter.
Yes, Mrs. Hacklett.
I want to apologize for the inexcusable conduct of my husband.
No apology is necessary.
On the contrary, Captain, I think it entirely necessary. He behaved like a boor and an oaf.
Madam, your husband apologized as a gentleman on his own behalf, and the matter is concluded. He nodded to her.
Good evening. Captain Hunter.
He stopped at the door and turned.
Yes, madam.
You are a most attractive man, Captain.
Madam, you are very gracious. I look forward to our next meeting.
I as well, Captain.
Hunter walked away, thinking that Mr. Hacklett had best look to his wife. Hunter had seen it happen before. A well-bred woman, reared in a rural gentry setting in England, who found some excitement in the court, as no doubt Mrs. Hacklett had, if her husband looked away, as no doubt Mr. Hacklett had. Nevertheless, on finding herself in the Indies, far from home, far from the restraints of class and custom, Hunter had seen it before. He walked down the cobbled street away from the mansion. He passed the cookhouse, still brightly lit, the servants working inside. All houses in Port Royal had separate cookhouses, a necessity in the hot climate. Through the open windows, he saw the figure of the blonde girl who had served dinner. He waved to her. She waved back and turned away to her work. They were baiting a bear outside Mrs. Denby's inn. Hunter watched the children pelt the helpless animal with rocks. They laughed and giggled and shouted as the bear growled and tugged at its stout chain. A couple of whores beat the bear with sticks. Hunter walked past and entered the inn. Trencher was there, sitting in a corner, drinking with his one good arm. Hunter called to him and drew him aside.
"What is it, Captain?"
Trencher asked eagerly.
"I want you to find some mates for me."
"Say who they shall be, Captain."
"Lazou, Mr. Enders, Sanson, and the Moor."
Trencher smiled.
"You want them here?"
"No. Find out where they are, and I'll seek them out. Now, where is Whisper?"
"In the Blue Goat," Trencher said. "The back room."
"And Black Eyes in Farrow Street?"
"I think so. You want the Jew, too, do you?"
"I am trusting your tongue," Hunter said. "Keep it still now."
"Will you take me with you, Captain?"
"If you do as you are told."
"I swear by God's wounds, Captain."
"Then look sharp," Hunter said, and left the inn, returning to the muddy street. The night air was warm and still, as it had been during the day. He heard the soft strumming of a guitar, and somewhere drunken laughter and a single gunshot. He set off down Ridge Street for the Blue Goat. The town of Port Royal was divided into rough sections, oriented around the port itself. Nearest the dockside were located the taverns and brothels and gaming houses. Farther back, away from the brawling activity of the waterfront, the streets were quieter. Here the grocers and backers, the furniture workers and ship's chandlers, the blacksmiths and goldsmiths could be found. Still farther back, on the south side of the bay, were the handful of respectable inns and private homes. The Blue Goat,
was a respectable inn. Hunter entered, nodding to the gentlemen drinking at the tables. He recognized the best landsman's doctor, Mr. Perkins, one of the councilmen, Mr. Pickering, the bailiff of the Bridewell Jail, and several other respectable gentlemen. Ordinarily, a common privateering seaman would not be welcome in the Blue Goat, but Hunter was accepted with good grace. This was a simple recognition of the way the commerce of the port depended upon a steady stream of successful privateering raids. Hunter was a skilled and daring captain, and thus an important member of the community. In the previous year, his three forays had returned more than 200,000 pistoles and doubloons to Port Royal. Much of this money found its way to the pockets of these gentlemen, and they greeted him accordingly. Mistress Wickham, who managed the Blue Goat, was less warm. A widow, she had some years before taken up with Whisper, and she knew, when Hunter arrived, that he had come to see him. She jerked her thumb toward a back room.
"In there, Captain."
"Thank you, Mistress Wickham." He crossed directly to the back room, knocked, and opened the door without hearing any answering greeting. He knew there would be none. The room was dark, lit only by a single candle. Hunter blinked to adjust to the light. He heard a rhythmic creaking. Finally, he was able to see Whisper, sitting in a corner, in a rocking chair. Whisper held a primed pistol, aimed at Hunter's belly. "A good evening, Whisper." The reply was low, a rasping hiss.
"A good evening, Captain Hunter. You are alone?"
"I am."
"Then come in,"
came the hissing reply.
"A touch of kill devil?"
Whisper pointed to a barrel beside him, which served as a table. There were glasses and a small crock of rum. "With thanks, Whisper." Hunter watched as Whisper poured two glasses of dark brown liquid. As his eyes adjusted to the light, he could see his companion better. Whisper, no one knew his real name, was a large, heavy-set man with oversized, pale hands. He had once been a successful privateering captain in his own right. Then he had gone on the Montanceros raid with Edmonds. Whisper was the sole survivor. After Cazala had captured him, cut his throat, and left him for dead. Somehow Whisper lived, but not without the loss of his voice. This and the large, white, arcing scar beneath his chin were obvious proofs of his past. Since his return to Port Royal, Whisper had hidden in this back room, a strong, vigorous man, but one without courage, the steel gone out of him. He was frightened. He was never without a weapon in his hands and another at his side. Now, as he rocked in his chair, Hunter saw the gleam of a cutlass on the floor within easy reach.
"What brings you, Captain? Montanceros?"
Hunter must have looked startled. Whisper broke into laughter. Whisper's laughter was a horrifying sound, a high-pitched wheezing sizzle like a steam kettle. He threw his head back to laugh, revealing the white scar plainly.
"I startle you, Captain. You are surprised, I know."
"Whisper," Hunter said. "Do others know?"
"Some,"
Whisper hissed.
"Or they suspect, but they do not understand. I heard the story of Morton's voyage."
"Ah."
"You are going, Captain?"
"Tell me about Montanceros, Whisper."
"You wish a map?"
"Yes."
15 shillings.
"Done," Hunter said. He knew he would pay Whisper 20 to ensure his friendship and his silence to any later visitors. And for his part, Whisper would know the obligation conferred by the extra 5 shillings. And he would know that Hunter would kill him if he spoke to anyone else about Montanceros. Whisper produced a scrap of oilcloth and a bit of charcoal. Placing the oilcloth on his knee, he sketched rapidly.
"The island of Montanceros. It means slaughter in the Danish tongue,"
he whispered.
"It has the shape of a U. So, the mouth of the harbor faces to the east, to the ocean. This point,"
he tapped the left-hand side of the U,
"is Punta Montanceros. That is where Cazala has built the fortress. It is low land here. The fortress is no more than 50 paces above the level of the water.
Hunter nodded and waited while Whisper gurgled a sip of Kill Devil.
The fortress is 8-sided. The walls are stone, 30 feet high. Inside there is a Spanish militia garrison.
Of what strength?
Some say 200. Some say 300. I have even heard 400, but do not believe it.
Hunter nodded. He should count on 300 troops. And the guns?
On 2 sides of the fortress only,
Whisper rasped.
1 battery to the ocean, due east. 1 battery across the mouth of the harbor, due south.
What guns are they? Whisper gave his chilling laugh.
Most interesting, Captain Hunter. They are Culebrinas, 24-pounders, cast bronze.
How many?
10, perhaps 12.
It was interesting, Hunter thought. The Culebrinas, what the English called culverins, were not the most powerful class of armament and were no longer favored for shipboard use. Instead, the stubby cannon had become standard on warships of every nationality. The culverin was an older gun. Culverins weighed more than 2 tons with barrels as long as 15 feet. Such long barrels made them deadly accurate at long range. They could fire heavy shot and were quick to load. In the hands of trained gun crews, culverins could be fired as often as once a minute. So it is well made, Hunter nodded. Who is the gunnery master?
Busquet.
I have heard of him, Hunter said. He is the man who sank the Renown?
The same,
Whisper hissed. So the gun crews would be well drilled. Hunter frowned. Whisper, he said, do you know if the culverins are fixed-mounted? Whisper rocked back and forth for a long moment.
You are insane, Captain Hunter.
How so?
You are planning a landward attack.
Hunter nodded.
It will never succeed,
Whisper said. He tapped the map on his knees.
Edmonds thought of it, but when he saw the island, he gave up the attempt. Look here, if you beach on the west,
he pointed to the curve of the U,
there is a small harbor which you can use. But to cross to the main harbor of Montanceros by land, you must scale the Laris Ridge to get to the other side.
Hunter made an impatient gesture. Is it difficult to scale the ridge?
It is impossible, Whisper said. The ordinary man cannot do it. Starting here from the western cove, the land gently slopes up for 500 feet or more. But it is a hot, dense jungle with many swamps. There is no fresh water. There will be patrols. If the patrols do not find you, and you do not die of fevers, you emerge at the base of the ridge. The western face of Laris Ridge is vertical rock for 300 feet. A bird cannot perch there. The wind is incessant with the force of a gale.
If I did scale it, Hunter said, what then?
The eastern slope is gentle and presents no difficulty,
Whisper said.
But you will never reach the eastern face, I promise you.
If I did, Hunter said, what of the Montanceros batteries? Whisper gave a little shrug.
They face the water, Captain Hunter. Cazalla is no fool. He knows he cannot be attacked from the land.
There is always a way. Whisper rocked in his chair, in silence, for a long time.
Not always,
he said finally.
Not always.
Don Diego de Romano, known also as Black Eye or simply as the Jew, sat hunched over his workbench in the shop on Faro Street. He blinked nearsightedly at the pearl, which he held between the thumb and forefinger of his left hand. They were the only remaining fingers on that hand.
It is of excellent quality, he said.
He handed the pearl back to Hunter.
I advise you to keep it.
Black Eye blinked rapidly. His eyes were weak and pink like a rabbit's.
Tears ran almost continuously from them. From time to time, he brushed them away. His right eye had a large black spot near the pupil, hence his name.
You did not need me to tell you this, Hunter.
No, Don Diego. The Jew nodded and got up from his bench. He crossed his narrow shop and closed the door to the street. Then he closed the shutters to the window and turned back to Hunter.
Well?
How is your health, Don Diego?
My health,
Don Diego said, pushing his hands deep into the pockets of his loose robe. He was sensitive about his injured left hand.
My health is indifferent, as always. You did not need me to tell you this, either.
Is the shop successful? Hunter asked, looking around the room. On rude tables, gold jewelry was displayed. The Jew had been selling from this shop for nearly 2 years now. Don Diego sat down. He looked at Hunter and stroked his beard and wiped away his tears.
Hunter, he said, you are vexing. Speak your mind.
I was wondering, Hunter said, if you still worked in powder.
Powder? Powder?
The Jew stared across the room, frowning as if he did not know the meaning of the word.
No, he said. I do not work in powder. Not after this.
He pointed to his blackened eye.
And after this.
He raised his fingerless left hand.
No longer do I work in powder.
Can your will be changed?
Never.
Never is a long time.
Never is what I mean, Hunter.
Not even to attack Kazala? The Jew grunted.
Kazala,
he said heavily.
Kazala is in Montanceros and cannot be attacked.
I am going to attack him, Hunter said quietly.
So did Captain Edmonds this year past.
Don Diego grimaced at the memory. He had been a partial backer of that expedition. His investment, £50, had been lost.
Matanceros is invulnerable, Hunter. Do not let vanity obscure your sense. The fortress cannot be overcome.
He wiped the tears from his cheek.
Besides, there is nothing there.
Nothing in the fortress, Hunter said. But in the harbor?
The harbor. The harbor.
Black Eye stared into space again.
What is in the harbor? Ah, it must be the treasure Naos lost in the August storm, yes?
One of them.
How do you know this?
I know.
One Nao?
The Jew blinked even more rapidly. He scratched his nose with the forefinger of his injured left hand, a sure sign he was lost in thought.
It is probably filled with tobacco and cinnamon, he said gloomily.
It is probably filled with gold and pearls, Hunter said. Otherwise it would have made straight for Spain and risked capture. It went to Matanceros only because the treasure is so great it dared not risk a seizure.
Perhaps.
Hunter watched the Jew carefully. The Jew was a great actor.
Suppose you are right, he said finally. It is of no interest to me. A Nao in Montanceros Harbor is as safe as if it were moored in Cadiz itself. It is protected by the fortress, and the fortress cannot be taken.
True, Hunter said. But the gun batteries which guard the harbor can be destroyed. If your health is good, and if you will work in powder once again.
You flatter me.
Most assuredly, I do not.
What has my health to do with this?
My plan, Hunter said, is not without its rigors. Don Diego frowned.
You are saying I must come with you?
Of course. What did you think?
I thought you wanted money. You want me to come?
It is essential, Don Diego. The Jew stood up abruptly.
To attack Kazala, he said,
suddenly excited. He began to pace back and forth.
I have dreamt of his death each night for 10 years, Hunter. I have dreamed.
He stopped pacing and looked at Hunter.
You also have your reasons.
I do, Hunter nodded.
But can it be done? Truly?
Truly, Don Diego.
Then I wish to hear the plan, the Jew said, very excited. And I wish to know what powder you need.
I need an invention, Hunter said. You must fabricate something which does not exist. The Jew wiped tears from his eyes.
Tell me, he said. Tell me.
Mr. Enders, the barber surgeon and sea artist, delicately applied the leech to his patient's neck. The man, leaning back in the chair, his face covered with a towel, groaned as the slug-like creature touched his flesh. Immediately, the leech began to swell with blood. Mr. Enders hummed quietly to himself. There now, he said. A few moments and you will feel much better. Mark me. You will breathe easier and show the ladies a thing or two as well. He patted the cheek that was under the towel. I shall just step outside for a breath of air and return in a moment. With that, Mr. Enders left the shop, for he had seen Hunter beckoning to him outside. Mr. Enders was a short man with quick, delicate movements. He seemed to dance rather than walk. He did a modest business in the port because many of his patients survived his ministrations, unlike those of other surgeons. But his greatest skill, and his true love, was piloting a vessel under sail. Enders, a genuine sea artist, was that rare creature, a perfect helmsman, a man who seemed to find communion between himself and the ship he guided.
Are you needing a shave, Captain? He asked Hunter.
A crew.
Then you have found your surgeon, Enders said. And what's the nature of the voyage?
Logwood cutting, Hunter said and grinned.
I am always pleased to cut logwood, Enders said. And whose logwood might it be?
Kazala's. Immediately, Enders dropped his bantering mood.
Kazala? You're going to Mutton Saros?
Softly, Hunter said, glancing around the street.
Captain! Captain, suicide is an offense against God.
You know that I need you, Hunter said.
But life is sweet, Captain.
So is gold, Hunter said.
Enders was silent, frowning. He knew, as the Jew knew, as everyone knew in Port Royal, that there was no gold in the fortress of Mutton Saros.
Perhaps you will explain?
It is better that I do not.
When do you sail?
In 2 days' time.
And we will hear the reasons in Bull Bay?
You have my word.
Enders silently extended his hand, and Hunter shook it. There was a writhing and a grunting from the patient in the shop.
Oh, dear, the poor fellow, Enders said, and ran back into the room.
The leech was fat with blood and dripping red drops onto the wooden floor. Enders lifted the leech away, and the patient screamed.
Now, now, do be calm, Your Excellency.
You are nothing but a damned pirate and rascal, said Sir James Almont, whipping the cloth off his face and daubing his bitten neck with it.
Lazoo was in a bawdy house on Lime Road, surrounded by giggling women. Lazoo was French. The name was a bastardization of les yeux, for these sailors' eyes were large and bright and legendary. Lazoo could see better than anyone in the dark of night. Many times, Hunter had gotten his ships through reefs and shoal water with the help of Lazoo on the forecastle. It was also true that this slender, cat-like person was an extraordinary marksman.
Hunter,
Lazoo growled, with an arm around a buxom girl.
Hunter, join us.
The girls giggled and played with their hair. A word in private, Lazoo.
You are so tedious,
Lazoo said, and kissed each of the girls in turn.
I shall return my sweets,
Lazoo said, and crossed with Hunter to a far corner. A girl brought them a crock of kill devil, and each a glass. Hunter looked at Lazoo's shoulder-length tangled hair and beardless face. Are you drunk, Lazoo?
Not too drunk, Captain,
Lazoo said, with a raucous laugh.
Speak your mind.
I am making a voyage in 2 days.
Yes?
Lazoo seemed to become suddenly sober,
the large, watchful eyes focused intently on Hunter.
A voyage to what end?
Matanceros. Lazu laughed a deep, rumbling growl of a laugh. It was an odd sound to come from so slight a body.
Matanceros means slaughter, and it is well named from all that I hear.
Nonetheless, Hunter said,
your reasons must be good.
They are. Lazu nodded, not expecting to hear more. A clever captain did not reveal much about a raid until the crew was underway.
Are the reasons as good as the dangers are great?
They are. Lazu searched Hunter's face.
You want a woman on this voyage?
That is why I am here. Lazu laughed again. She scratched her small breasts absently. Though she dressed and acted and fought like a man, Lazu was a woman. Her story was known to few, but Hunter was one. Lazu was the daughter of a Brittany seaman's wife. Her husband was at sea when the wife found she was pregnant and subsequently delivered a son. However, the husband never returned. Indeed, he was never heard from again, and after some months, the woman found herself pregnant a second time. Fearing scandal, she moved to another village in the province, where she delivered a daughter, Lazu. A year passed and the son died. Meanwhile, the mother ran out of funds and found it necessary to return to her native village to live with her parents. To avoid dishonor, she dressed her daughter as her son, and the deception was so complete that no one in the village, including the child's grandparents, ever suspected the truth. Lazu grew up as a boy, and at 13 was made a coachman for a local nobleman. Later, she joined the French army and lived for several years among troops without ever being discovered. Finally, at least as she told the story, she fell in love with a handsome young cavalry officer and revealed her secret to him. They had a passionate affair, but he never married her, and when it ended, she chose to come to the West Indies, where she again resumed her masculine role. In a town like Port Royal, such a secret could not be kept long, and indeed everyone knew that Lazu was a woman. In any case, during privateering raids, she was in the habit of baring her breasts in order to confuse and terrify the enemy. But in the port, she was customarily treated like a man, and no one made any great cause over it. Now Lazu laughed.
You are mad, Hunter, to attack Matanceros.
Will you come?
She laughed again. Only because I have nothing better to do.
And she went back to the giggling whores at the far table. Hunter found the Moor, in the early morning hours, playing a hand of Gleek with two Dutch corsairs at a gaming house called the Yellow Scamp. The Moor, also called Bassa, was a huge man with a giant head, flat slabs of muscle on his shoulders and chest, heavy arms and thick hands which curled around the playing cards and made them seem tiny. He was called the Moor for reasons long since forgotten, and even if he were inclined to tell of his origins, he could not do so, for his tongue had been cut out by a Spanish plantation owner on Hispaniola. It was generally agreed that the Moor was not Moorish at all, but had come from the region of Africa called Nubia, a desert land along the Nile, populated by enormous black men. His given name, Bassa, was a port on the Guinea coast, where slavers sometimes stopped, but all agreed that the Moor could not have come from that land, since the natives were sickly and much paler in color. The fact that the Moor was mute and had to communicate with gestures increased the physical impression that he made. On occasion, newly arrived visitors to the port assumed that Bassa was stupid as well as mute, and as Hunter watched the card game in progress, he suspected that this was happening again. He took a tankard of wine to a side table and sat back to enjoy the spectacle. The Dutchmen were dandies, elegantly dressed in fine hose and embroidered silk tunics. They were drinking heavily. The Moor did not drink at all. Indeed, he never drank. There was a story that he could not tolerate liquor, and that once he had gotten drunk and killed five men with his bare hands before he came to his senses. Whether this was true or not, it was certainly true that the Moor had murdered the plantation owner who had cut out his tongue, then murdered his wife and half the household,
before making his escape to the pirate ports on the western side of Hispaniola, and from there to Port Royal. Hunter watched the Dutchmen as they bet. They were gambling recklessly, joking and laughing in high spirits. The Moor sat impassively, with a stack of gold coins in front of him. Gleek was a swift game that did not warrant casual betting, and indeed, as Hunter watched, the Moor drew three cards alike, showed them, and scooped up the Dutchman's money. They stared in silence a moment, and then both shouted, "Cheat!" in several languages. The Moor shook his enormous head calmly and pocketed the money. The Dutchman insisted that they play another hand, but in a gesture, the Moor indicated that they had no money left to bet. At this, the Dutchman became quarrelsome, shouting and pointing to the Moor. Bassa remained impassive, but a serving boy came over, and he handed the boy a single gold doubloon. The Dutchman apparently did not understand that the Moor was paying in advance for any damage that he might cause the gaming house. The serving boy took the coin and fled to a safe distance. The Dutchmen were now standing and shouting curses at the Moor, who remained seated at the table. His face was bland, but his eyes flicked back and forth from one man to the other. The Dutchmen became more quarrelsome, holding out their hands and demanding the return of their money. The Moor shook his head. Then one of the Dutchmen pulled a dagger from his belt and brandished it in front of the Moor, just inches from his nose. Still, the Moor remained impassive. He sat very still, with both hands folded in front of him on the table. The other Dutchman started to tug a pistol out of his belt, and with that, the Moor sprang into action. His large black hand flicked out, gripped the dagger in the Dutchman's hand, and swung the blade down, burying it 3 inches deep in the tabletop. Then he struck the second Dutchman in the stomach. The man dropped his pistol and bent over, coughing. The Moor kicked him in the face and sent him sprawling across the room. He then turned back to the first Dutchman, whose eyes were wide with terror. The Moor picked him up bodily, held him high over his head, walked to the door, and flung the man through the air, out into the street, where he landed spread-eagled on his face in the mud. The Moor returned to the room, plucked the knife out of the table, slipped it into his own belt, and crossed the room to sit next to Hunter. Only then did he allow himself a smile. "New men," Hunter said. The Moor nodded, grinning. Then he frowned and pointed to Hunter. His face was questioning. "I came to see you." The Moor shrugged. "We sail in 2 days." The Moor pursed his lips, mouthing a single word. "Ooh." "Matanceros," Hunter said. The Moor looked disgusted. "You're not interested?" The Moor smirked and drew a forefinger across his throat. "I tell you, it can be done," Hunter said. "Are you afraid of heights?" The Moor made a hand-over-hand gesture and shook his head. "I don't mean a ship's rigging," Hunter said. "I mean a cliff. A high cliff, 300 or 400 feet. The Moor scratched his forehead. He looked at the ceiling, apparently imagining the height of the cliff. Finally, he nodded. "You can do it?" He nodded again. "Even in a high wind?" "Good. Then you'll go with us." Hunter started to get up, but the Moor pushed him back into his chair. The Moor jangled the coins in his pocket and pointed a questioning finger at Hunter. "Don't worry," Hunter said. "It's worth it." The Moor smiled. Hunter left. He found Saint-Saëns in a second room floor of the Queen's Arms. Hunter knocked on the door and waited. He heard a giggle and a sigh, then knocked again. A surprisingly high voice called, "Damn you to hell and begone!" Hunter hesitated and knocked again. "God's blood, who is it now?" came the voice from inside. "Hunter." "Damn me! Come in, Hunter!" Hunter opened the door, letting it swing wide, but he did not enter. A moment later, the chamber pot and its contents came flying through the open door. Hunter heard a soft chuckle from inside the room.
"Cautious as ever, Hunter. You will outlive us all. Enter."
Hunter entered the room,
By the light of a single candle, he saw Sanson sitting up in bed next to a blonde girl.
"You have interrupted us, my son," Sanson said. "Let us pray that you have good reason."
"I do," Hunter said. There was a moment of awkward silence as the two men stared at each other. Sanson scratched his heavy black beard.
"Am I to guess the reason for your coming?"
"No," Hunter said, glancing at the girl.
"Ah,"
Sanson said. He turned to the girl.
"My delicate peach."
He kissed the tips of her fingers and pointed with his hand across the room. The girl immediately scrambled naked out of bed, hastily grabbed up her clothes, and bolted from the room.
"Such a delightful creature," Sanson said.
Hunter closed the door.
"She is French, you know," Sanson said. "French women make the best lovers, don't you agree?"
"They certainly make the best whores." Sanson laughed. He was a large, heavy man who gave the impression of brooding darkness. Dark hair, dark eyebrows that met over the nose, dark beard, dark skin. But his voice was surprisingly high, especially when he laughed.
"Can I not entice you to agree that French women are superior to English women?"
"Only in the prevalence of disease."
Sanson laughed heartily. "Hunter, your sense of humor is most unusual. Will you take a glass of wine with me?"
"With pleasure." Sanson poured from the bottle on his bedside table. Hunter took the glass and raised it in a toast.
"Your health."
"And yours," Sanson said, and they drank. Neither man took his eyes off the other. For his part, Hunter plainly did not trust Sanson. He did not, in fact, wish to take Sanson on the expedition, but the Frenchman was necessary to the success of the undertaking. For Sanson, despite his pride, his vanity, and his boasting, was the most ruthless killer in all the Caribbean. He came, in fact, from a family of French executioners. Indeed, his very name, Sanson, meaning without sound, was an ironic comment on the stealthy way that he worked. He was known and feared everywhere. It was said that his father, Charles Sanson, was the king's executioner in Dieppe. It was rumored that Sanson himself had been a priest in Liège for a short time, until his indiscretions with the nuns of a nearby convent made it advantageous for him to leave the country. But Port Royal was not a town where much attention was paid to past histories. Here, Sanson was known for his skill with the saber, the pistol, and his favorite weapon, the crossbow. Sanson laughed again.
"Well, my son, tell me what troubles you."
"I am leaving in 2 days' time, for Matanceros." Sanson did not laugh.
"You want me to go with you to Matanceros?"
"Yes." Sanson poured more wine.
"I do not want to go there," he said. "No sane man wants to go to Matanceros. Why do you want to go to Matanceros?"
Hunter said nothing. Sanson frowned at his feet at the bottom of the bed. He wiggled his toes, still frowning.
"It must be the galleons," he said finally. "The galleons lost in the storm have made Matanceros. Is that it?"
Hunter shrugged.
"Cautious, cautious," Sanson said.
"Well then, what terms do you make for this madman's expedition?" "I will give you 4 shares.
4 shares? You are a stingy man, Captain Hunter. My pride is injured. You think me worthy only 4 shares?
5 shares, Hunter said, with the air of a man giving in.
5? Let us say 8, and be done with it.
Let us say 5, and be done with it.
Hunter, the hour is late, and I am not patient. Shall we say 7?
6.
God's blood, you are stingy.
6, Hunter repeated.
7. Have another glass of wine.
Hunter looked at him and decided that the argument was not important. Sanson would be easier to control if he felt he had bargained well. He would be difficult and without humor if he believed he had been unjustly treated. 7, then, Hunter said.
My friend, you have great reason.
Sanson extended his hand.
Now tell me the manner of your attack.
Sanson listened to the plan without saying a word, and finally, when Hunter was finished, he slapped his thigh.
It is true what they say, he said, about Spanish sloth, French elegance, and English craft.
I think it will work, Hunter said.
I do not doubt it for a heartbeat, Sanson said.
When Hunter left the small room, dawn was breaking over the streets of Port Royal. Chapter 8. It was, of course, impossible to keep the expedition secret. Too many seamen were eager for a berth on any privateering expedition, and too many merchants and farmers were needed to fit out Hunter's sloop, Cassandra. By early morning, all of Port Royal was talking of Hunter's coming foray. It was said that Hunter was attacking Campeche. It was said that he would sack Maracaibo. It was even said that he dared to attack Panama, as Drake had done some 70 years before. But such a long sea voyage implied heavy provisioning, and Hunter was laying in so few supplies that most gossips believed the target of the raid was Havana itself. Havana had never been attacked by privateers. The very idea struck most people as mad. Other puzzling information came to light. Black Eye, the Jew, was buying rats from children and scamps around the docks. Why the Jew should want rats was a question beyond the imagination of any seaman. It was also known that Black Eye had purchased the entrails of a pig, which might be used for divination, but surely not by a Jew. Meanwhile, the Jew's gold shop was locked and boarded. The Jew was off somewhere in the hills of the mainland. He had gone off before dawn with a quantity of sulfur, saltpeter, and charcoal. The provisioning of the Cassandra was equally strange. Only a limited supply of salt pork was ordered, but a large quantity of water was required, including several small casks, which the barrel maker, Mr. Longley, had been asked to fabricate specially. The hemp shop of Mr. Whitstall had received an order for more than 1,000 feet of stout rope, rope too stout for use in a sloop's rigging. The sailmaker, Mr. Nedley, had been told to sew several large canvas bags with grommet fasteners at the top. And Carver, the blacksmith, was forging grappling hooks of peculiar design. The prongs were hinged, so the hooks could be folded small and flat. There was also an omen. During the morning, fishermen caught a giant hammerhead shark and hauled it onto the docks near Chocolata Hole, where the turtle crawls were located. The shark was more than 12 feet long, and with its broad snout, with eyes placed at each flattened protuberance, it was remarkably ugly. Fishermen and passers-by discharged their pistols into the animal, with no discernible effect. The shark flopped and writhed on the dockside planking until well into midday. Then the shark was slit open at the underbelly, and the slimy coils of intestines spilled forth. A glint of metal was perceived, and when the innards were cut open, the metal was seen to be the full suit of armor of a Spanish soldier, breastplate, ridged helmet, knee guards. From this it was deduced that the flathead shark had consumed the unfortunate soldier whole, digesting the flesh but retaining the armor, which the shark was unable to pass. This was variously taken as an omen of an impending Spanish attack on Port Royal, or as proof that Hunter was himself going to attack the Spanish. Sir James Almont had no time for omens. That morning he was engaged in questioning a French rascal named Lolonet, who had arrived in port that morning with a Spanish brig as his prize. Lolonet had no letters of marque, and in any case, England and Spain were nominally at peace. Worse than that was the fact that the brig contained, at the time it arrived in port, nothing of particular value. Some hides and tobacco were all that were to be found in its hold. Although renowned as a corsair, Lolonet was a stupid, brutal man. It did not take much intelligence, of course, to be a privateer. One had only to wait in the proper latitudes until a likely vessel happened along and then attack it. Standing with his hat in his hands in the governor's office, Lolonet now recited his unlikely tale with childish innocence. He had happened upon the prize vessel, he said, and found it deserted. There were no passengers aboard, and the ship was drifting aimlessly.
"Faith, some plague or calamity must have fallen it," L'Olonnais said. "But 'twas a goodly ship, sire, and I felt a service to the crown to bring it back to port, sire."
"You found no passengers at all?"
"Not a living thing."
"No dead aboard the ship?"
"Nay, sire."
"And no clue as to its misfortune?"
"Nary a one, sire."
"And the cargo?"
"As your own inspectors found it, sire. We'd not touch it, sire. You know that."
Sir James wondered how many innocent people L'Olonnais had murdered to clear the decks of that merchantman. And he wondered where the pirate had landed to hide the valuables of the cargo. There were 1,000 islands and small brackish keys throughout the Carib Sea that could serve his purposes. Sir James rapped his fingers on his desk. The man was obviously lying, but he needed proof. Even in the rough environment of Port Royal, English law prevailed.
"Very well," he said at last. "I shall formally state to you that the Crown is much displeased with this capture. The King, therefore, shall take a fifth."
"A fifth?"
Normally the King took a tenth, or even a fifteenth.
"Indeed," Sir James said evenly. "His Majesty shall have a fifth, and I shall formally state to you further that if any evidence reaches my ears of dastardly conduct on your part, you shall be brought to trial and hanged as a pirate and murderer."
"Sire, I swear to you that—"
"Enough," Sir James said, raising his hand. "You are free to go for the moment, but bear my words in mind."
L'Olonnais bowed elaborately and backed out of the room. Almont rang for his aide.
"John," he said, "find some of the seamen of L'Olonnais and see that their tongues are well oiled with wine. I want to know how he came to take that vessel, and I want substantial proofs against him."
"Very good, Your Excellency."
"And John, set aside the tenth for the king and a tenth for the governor."
"Yes, Your Excellency."
"That will be all."
John bowed.
"Your Excellency, Captain Hunter is here for his papers."
"Then show him in."
Hunter strode in a moment later. Almont stood and shook his hand.
"You seem in good spirits, Captain."
"I am, Sir James."
"The preparations go well?"
"They do, Sir James."
"At what cost?"
500 doubloons, Sir James."
Almont had anticipated the sum. He produced a sack of coin from his desk.
"This will suffice."
Hunter bowed as he took the money.
"Now then," Sir James said, "I have caused to be drawn up the paper of mark for the cutting of logwood at any location you deem proper and fitting."
He handed the letter to Hunter. In 1665, logwood cutting was considered legitimate commerce by the English, though the Spanish claimed a monopoly on that trade. The wood of the logwood, Hematoxylon compacium, was used in making red dye as well as certain medicines. It was a substance as valuable as tobacco.
"I must advise you," Sir James said slowly, "that we cannot countenance any attack upon any Spanish settlement in the absence of provocation."
"I understand," Hunter said.
"Do you suppose there shall be any provocation?"
"I doubt it, Sir James."
"Then of course your attack on Matanceros will be piratical."
"Sir James, our poor sloop Cassandra, lightly armed and by the proofs of your papers engaged in commerce, may suffer to be fired upon by the Matanceros guns. In that instance, are we not forced to retaliate? An unwarranted shelling of an innocent vessel cannot be countenanced."
"Indeed not," Sir James said. "I am sure I can trust you to act as a soldier and a gentleman."
"I will not betray your confidence."
Hunter turned to go.
"One last thing," Sir James said. "Cazalla is a favorite of Philip. Cazalla's daughter is married to Philip's vice-chancellor. Any message from Cazalla describing the events at Matanceros differently from your account
would be most embarrassing to His Majesty King Charles.
I doubt, Hunter said, that there will be dispatches from Kazala.
It is important that there not be.
Dispatches are not received from the depths of the sea.
Indeed not, Sir James said. The two men shook hands.
As Hunter was leaving the governor's mansion, a black woman servant handed him a letter, then wordlessly turned and walked away. Hunter descended the steps of the mansion, reading the letter, which was drafted in a feminine hand.
My dear Captain, I am lately informed that a beautiful fresh spring can be found on the main portion of the Jamaican island, at the place called Crawford's Valley. To acquaint myself with the delights of my new residence, I shall make an excursion to this spot in the latter part of the day, and I hope that it is as exquisite as I am led to believe. Fondly I am, Emily Hacklett.
Hunter slipped the letter into his pocket.